This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Thai Nguyen. In 1977, I became the first Vietnamese in America to reach.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of. What was it like when you first got here? Because I understand you got here really early, way before 1975.
My mother brought us over here from Vietnam in 1967, April the 13th to be exact. It was very different. Back in those days, there were no Vietnamese kids around. Just my brother and I. We went to a preschool daycare center. We're the only Vietnamese in the whole area. Matter of fact, I think we were the first one in the county to be kids coming there. It was very strange. You're leaving Vietnam with 80, 90 degree humid weather. Then you go to San Diego, which is still nice, but you know, very dry, a little bit colder, and nobody spoke your language.
Yeah.
We didn't have the, you know, things like ESL like they have now. You know, back then they just throw you into the woods and learn English or sink or swim.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
Being Vietnamese means you have to have cultural pride. Coming here from a different country as a foreigner, you know, coming here and adapting and being proud now to be an American and still keeping my Vietnamese culture, whether it's food, observation like New Year's, you know, we celebrate Tet at the same time you celebrate Christmas. And teaching my kids what it is to be Vietnamese and half African-American, which is very special.
Yeah, we'll get into that. It's a very interesting story. Now, what did your mom and dad do when you first arrived?
My mom in Vietnam worked for the American Embassy. She worked in there and she found out there's a program to send Vietnamese people to the United States to teach Vietnamese to American soldiers. My mom being at that time trilingual, she spoke fluent French, fluent Vietnamese, and fluent English. So she took us two boys over there. Going back a little bit, my mom and dad got divorced right before that, which is almost unheard of, you know, in Vietnam back in the 60s. So my dad was a soldier, and my mom just took two boys to America by herself.
That takes a lot of courage. Yeah.
Yes.
That takes a lot of courage for a woman to leave back in those days, her husband and family behind.
Yeah, you know, the Vietnamese culture back then, a very family oriented. For a woman to just pick up and take two kids in 1967 was almost unheard of. My aunt was over in America at that time, right before that. I think she was over here about a year. She was doing the same thing, teaching a Vietnamese American soldier. And she's the one that I believe told my mom about the whole program.
Yeah, that's a pretty unique thing to have these women lead the way, such an early age to watch, you know, the strength of these women who didn't know the lay of the land here and to resettle here and to thrive and to raise two sons that kick some butt, right?
Yeah, she gave us a lot of, you know, what it is to be Vietnamese and to honor your culture and honor the discipline that's involved. And she was very interesting. My mom always told us, you know, you speak English when you're at school and you come home, and we come home, she speaks Vietnamese to us. You know, so we kept our culture, the language, you know, what it is to be Vietnamese, instead of just totally assimilating.
Yeah, a lot of parents that would come after that in 1975 would push their kids to not speak any Vietnamese at all. So there's a quicker assimilation process.
Yes, there is. She had foresight to know that you need your Vietnamese language, you know, fast forward to your adult life. Have been bilingual was a plus for me in my career and work and everything. You know, and as a 7 year old, not knowing that, because 7 years old, you just want to speak English because you want to talk to other kids.
Yeah.
It was very hard when you don't even speak the language.
And especially probably getting pushed around by, you know, these American kids who, you know, seeing somebody who's different, who can't speak the language, just having that foresight to retain the Vietnamese and pick up a new language like English is an incredibly amount of foresight, because now that we are 50 years, almost 50 years later, we see sort of like a lot of the parents making that mistake 40 years ago when they were raising their kids to really push them into English only households.
In those days, and me being a little kid, I remember getting a lot of fights because, you know, kids are laughing. I just assumed they were laughing at me, you know, whether they were or not, you know, because you didn't understand what they were talking about. And they're looking at you, they're laughing. You're not sure if they're telling a joke or talking about you. And the fight was on.
Yeah.
I remember Miss Elsie Peterson used to grab me and try to convey with me when my mom came and picked us up that they weren't laughing at you. They were just talking, telling your stories and joke. And, you know, for me to basically cool my temper, you know, because you know, it can't be just a fight all the time to hear somebody laugh. But, you know, as a young kid, it's also frustrating because you don't understand what these kids are saying.
Now, what led you to joining the Marine Corps?
I was going through high school, and at that time, we also brought a lot of, my mom brought a lot of, sponsored a lot of our relatives over here in 75. It was total chaos at the house. She was trying to bring over and sponsor people living in our house, you know, two or three families. We didn't have money for college or anything because on paper, it looks like we made a lot of decent money, right? Like middle class. But in real life, it's not really, because you know, you're paying for two or three different families coming over from Vietnam. And, you know, you, of course, when that those days, you had no receipts for things like that. You just pay for it. When they came over here, you sponsor them, you know, you pay for their living wages, you pay for their food, whatever you had to do. So in 77, I decided to join the Marine Corps. I started going to service to pay for school. I was doing a little research on it. I figured if I go into United States military, I could get money for school. And also, when I went down to talk to the recruiter, they said, also, you get the U.S. citizenship at the same time, you know, if you could complete your tour and got an honorable discharge and everything like that. So instead of going to college, I sat my mom down. I was in 11th grade because I had enough credit to graduate early. I go, I need you to sign these papers because you were under 18 and for me to go to the Marine Corps. And she kind of looked at me with those, you know, kind of, you know, sideways eyes, you know, just the sideways eyes moms give to you. Considering we just came from a war-torn country with, yeah, you know, she had deaths in the family from the war. Here's a kid wants to join the service. And she was mentioning, don't you want to join the Coast Guard or Navy or something? Why do you want to join the Marines? Because, you know, being a Marine, you're on the front lines the whole time. But, you know, I told her, trust me, I'm going to do what I need to do. And she did. She knew that I had a pretty square, you know, level head up on her shoulder. I said, I'm going to go to college afterward, but I want to get this Marine Corps enlistment in there and then start my life. And that's what I did.
You know, my mom had to do that with me too. That was our trajectory, a shared trajectory that you and I have. At 17, my mom signed the papers. And both my mom and dad were like, wait a minute. 17 years ago, we had just left a war-torn country, so you would never have to join the military. So I'm sure it's like mind-boggling for this previous generation to sign papers for us to join. I mean, it's not like we join at 18 where you just join and you sign your own papers.
Right.
Both of our parents had to sign at 17, and I did the same thing that you did. I had enough college credits to, or high school credits to graduate at 16. By the time I turned 17, I was like a year in to community college. And they were just like, really? You're going to throw that all away to join the military?
Yeah, because my mom had college aspirations for me. You
know? Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I wasn't no straight-A student, but I had enough to get into college. But the way I had my grades and everything, I wasn't going to get those full-ride academic scholarships or anything. I was going to get like the Cal Grants, and, you know,
yeah,
a hook and crook here and there, some financial aid. But it wasn't enough for college. I didn't want to. People say, you're kind of old for your, wise for your age. I didn't want to be leaving college. Yeah, I got this fancy piece of paper, but I'm thousands in debt. So I figured the service was the best way. And I go, if I'm going to do the service, I might as well join the toughest one to give me my, you know, to force me to discipline and to give me the challenge. And that's funny. When I went to my Marine Corps recruiter in Oakland, there's a two-story building. It's the Armed Forces Recruiting Unit on Telegraph. You walk in, downstairs, the Army and the Marines. Upstairs is the Navy and Coast Guard. First officer to walk in was a guy named Staff Sergeant Bill Squires. he looked at me. I said, "Hey, I'm here. I want to join the service." He goes, "Where are you from?" "I'm from Berkeley." He goes, "Oh, Navy and Coast Guard is upstairs." I go, "No, I'm here to join the Marine Corps." I remember he looked at me. He was wearing glasses. He took off his glasses. "Let me see your ID." He looked at me. I looked at him. He goes, and I looked at his campaign ribbons. I mean, his ribbons. And I go, "Oh, he did two tours of Vietnam. You know, you get the yellow ribbon thread. You see the two stars because you know he did two tours." And he kind of got not like a shock factor. I remember him calling his the LT at the command center and at him. He goes, "You're not going to believe this, LT. There's a kid here that wants to join the Marine Corps. He's from Berkeley." He goes, "Check this out. He's Vietnamese, too." And I could hear the LT yell in the background, "No way. I'll be right down." You know? And the lieutenant came in and did the same thing. Looked at my ID and then, you know, looked at me up and down. "Are you born here in Vietnam? Are you mixer?" I go, "No, I'm Vietnamese. I was born in Saigon."
I remember going through back in 93. And some of my drill instructors had, the company commander or the first sergeant were, they did tours in Vietnam. And it was just 17 years later or, you know, 18, 19 years before that these young, when they were younger, they were in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so getting there was a very confusing thing for me because sometimes Americans at the time couldn't really distinguish. For some reason, culturally, they just didn't understand that, or they were just so ignorant that they didn't realize that there were two camps, the Vietnamese that were fighting in black pajamas in Vietnam, and the other side, which is the South Vietnamese Army, and we were the product of the South, and they couldn't. A lot of the drill instructors at the time couldn't understand that, or the kids that were going through the Marine Corps with me, they didn't understand like there's these two things, and I can't imagine. You going in 77, which is like literally just a few years before that, we were like at all-time war with, you know, with the same country. So how did that play out in boot camp and your time in the service?
It was very interesting and kind of shocking because I walk in there and my drill instructor, two out of the three were Vietnam vets. Right. Remember, you had three drill instructors.
Yeah.
You had the primary one and two secondaries.
Senior
primary was a senior sergeant. You know, he's the one that barked more orders than anybody else. And he had three campaigns in Vietnam, you know, two rows of ribbons, you know. And I remember the first thing I did was in the middle of the bus, I remember my staff sergeant, Bill Scribe, my recruit, goes, "Hey, Wynn, make sure you sit in the middle of the bus. Get that haircut of yours a little bit more short than what it was." Because, you know, I grew up in Berkeley, man. You know, so my hair was long down to my shoulder, you know. I was the kid that used to ride around on a motorcycle in a big old orange t-shirt that said Question Authority. So, you know, that's a little wild streak. Typically not Vietnamese back then, you know. I was a motorcycle rider. I hung out with my friends. And, you know, I was a gearhead, you know. Not into the academia like most Vietnamese back then were, you know. The drill instructor comes on the bus. The first guy comes on. He's yelling and screaming for, you know, everybody get the F off the bus and yelling. And he goes, "Where's that Nugent guy?" I'm going, "Who's Nugent?" I'm not thinking about it. He goes, "Nugent, where's Nugent?" I'm not saying nothing. Right? He goes, he spelled my name. He goes, "Me." I go, "Didn't you hear me call you the first three times?" I go, "No, my name is Nguyen." He goes, "No, it's Nugent." And then we got to that, you know, the first thing you do off that bus, you stand on those little, you know, markers. With the footprints, remember those things? So you stand on the markers with the footprints. You put your feet, your left foot on one print, you put your right foot, you're just screaming these orders at you. And they might kind of gaggle you into the haircut, you know, the barber. They got these barbers lined up in rows. And as my turn comes out, the drill instructor goes, "I want to cut his hair personally." I go, "Why am I getting picked on? They told me to sit in the middle of the bus and keep my mouth shut. I should be able to blend in, you know, not as a kid, not realize they know who you are before you can cut. They already got your name for all the 80 guys you joined with." And then from there, they razzed me through boot camp, but then they pushed me really hard doing different things. But towards the end, I realized why. When they knew you were going to graduate, like the last week of boot camp, mostly it's spit shine and increasing your, you know, putting all your drills in. The senior drill sergeant, "We pushed you hard because we fought with American Marines. They were the best, I mean, Vietnamese Marines. They told me they were the best fighters that were ever fought with in their whole career." These are, you know, pretty senior Marines. And he said, "We expected you no less to make your country proud. Now you're an American Marine. And, you know, you're going to be an American Marine in a week if we pass it." But then it was kind of neat at the end because I got to meet the, you know, the majors in charge, the captain, officers that other guys didn't get to meet because they wanted to see this Vietnamese that made it through the Marine Corps, you know, which was like unheard of back then. Because in boot camp, they told me, you know, when you're the first Vietnamese and American Marines. I didn't know that. I
mean, how did they prove that? How did you know that that was like a real?
He said they researched the paperwork. That's why it took them a long time. You know, back then, they didn't have computers like now. You know, they had to just research it. Remember, Marine Corps archives back then wasn't like now where you, you know, press the send button and away you go. And most of the stuff was hand filed with microfiches and stuff like that. They went back to the Marine Corps headquarters and they found out. I found that out about, I don't know, 10 weeks into boot camp. Somewhere around there. I thought I got in trouble. I got called into the drill instructor's office. And they yelled at me, "Why did you tell me you're the first Vietnamese Marine?" I go, "I can't tell you something I didn't know." I'm thinking to myself, you know?
Yeah. Now your upbringing in Berkeley, there's a lot of, and I don't mean, there's no pun intended, there's a lot of color there. Because Berkeley is a very diverse town, there's a lot going on, and it's not typically a town where you think produces military men or women.
None.
It's not San Diego. No. It's not Coronado. It's not, you know,
not Texas.
Not Texas. You're not getting you know, these corn-fed Marines that come out of the fields of Kentucky. You have a very intellectual and very diverse exposure to, you know, we talked about this before, but the Delphonics and Motown at the time. And I can't imagine what the cultural sort of the differences of the intellectual set from Berkeley and that town, and then being in the Marine Corps and seeing such rigidity. How did you mitigate sort of like the differences in that world?
Well, I was blessed to be raised in Berkeley. Born in Vietnam, raised in Berkeley most of my childhood life. The reason why is Berkeley is very diverse. It was diverse before diverse being a cool thing. You know, it was just the way the town was a melting pot. One, it was a university town with UC Berkeley there. You know, the home of all the political strife and Vietnam War, anti-war, which I saw growing up. You know, I experienced a lot of that, you know, firsthand, seeing the demonstration and some of the riots and everything. But Berkeley, the way Berkeley school district in those days was very free thinking. They never taught you about, there was no Black pride, Asian pride, none of that stuff. You were just a student and you're mixing this class with Asians, Blacks, whites, every other color in between. Nobody really looked at color. You look at people that are your friends, that are nice to you, or you're nice to them, you just click. It was a very special kind of upbringing that you never had, you know, anywhere else. And growing up in Berkeley, I thought everything like that was normal. I thought everybody was mixed, you know, not knowing the rest of the United States. So it's a little bit different in the 70s. And it taught you to be tolerant of all these races, not be this deep because you were totally immersed in it. You didn't think anything of it. Like I grew up mostly in a Black community. I mean, my house, but you know, my mom had us raised up in middle school and junior and high school, a Black community, literally the only Asian in the whole neighborhood, but nobody made me feel uncomfortable. I mean, it was no big deal. You know, we moved in, oh, that's an Asian kid. But I knew that while I lived in that neighborhood, I can't get in trouble because they know where, you know, if anybody said, hey, the Asian kid did it, they know who the cops came to, you know, the cops did. But with that in mind, it made me a free thinker because, yeah, look at it, in the 70s, a lot of Vietnamese that I knew as I grew up, I saw some Vietnamese come over in 75, especially in high school. You started seeing trickle of Vietnamese coming in, kids. They're very rigid, very Vietnamese. They hung out with only Vietnamese. They only did things with Vietnamese. They all had a little, how do you call it, a stereotype, you know, very bookish. And, you know, they looked at me like I was the wild thing. You know, even the Vietnamese girls back then looked at me with a side eye because you're not Vietnamese. You know, I hung out with my friends and, you know, I was a gearhead. I played soccer. And, you know, I did my own thing. Hang out with the boys. No Vietnamese at all.
This colorful past of growing up in Berkeley and then joining the Marine Corps that led you eventually to becoming a police officer, you know, it is something that I feel like today when we think of the police force and we think of the BLM movement and we think of all the racial chaos that's happening in the last few years, we could use a lot of people with the background like yours, but that's not really the luxury that we have in the United States. We have a lot of, you know, officers that have very little to no diversity in their upbringing that maybe is a reason why we've landed in such hot water. I mean, what kind of experience did you go through as a police officer with people around you who perhaps didn't understand that the challenges of diversity was an important thing?
Well, you know, as being a retired law enforcement officer, I did 35 years working in law enforcement. And when I came out at 85, you know, it all starts at the beginning and who the city agencies hire. Every city gets a choice of what kind of officer they want to represent that city. If it's a city that's really going out there and trying to find a police officer that represents the people in their city and have a mindset that's very open, but that's up to the chief of police and the HR to hire those kind of people. But if you have a police chief that's very close-minded, he came from the old schools of the 50s and 60s and 70s where they didn't do that, then you're gonna have a product of these officers that you have today. And I also see officers now that were different from what I was in. When I first came in 85, very few officers went to college. Most police officers, not that they were dumb or they couldn't get in, it's just not their chosen path, you know. Most of the chosen paths of the officers back in those days was you come out of high school, most of us joined the military because over half my people that I joined that day were all ex-military. And then you go have an adult life doing different things, then you apply for a policeman. And most young men that did not go to college, they went out and worked in the field, whatever they were doing, you know, whether they're construction, carpenter, whatever, they made a living. And now they're in their mid-20s with a life, you know, they've never had adult experience, dealt away from mom and dad's cocoon, you know, and went in there and found out how other people live their life and work in there. So you have more of a cultural awareness. Then you become a policeman. And when you're a policeman as a young rookie cop, 85, don't get me wrong, there were racist cops that I worked with. But I was hired by a very special chief who had a forward vision, a guy named Robert McGinnis, phenomenal man. He was the chief of San Leandro. I met him first in the police academy. He wasn't my first chief. I started out in East Palo Alto, we were like, you know, war-torn, you know, they call it the ghettos, inner city, a high crime rate city. But when I went to San Leandro, he found out I was looking for a different lateral movement. He recruited me. And he called me in there and he wanted an officer that's going to represent this. You know, he's forward thinking. He wanted more minority officer in the city of San Leandro and wanted to represent the way the community was evolving. So his mindset, not that I knew any, but it's kind of interesting, but, you know, seemed like every third of us that he hired and got the job were minorities. And that made up the makeup of San Leandro. So you don't hear San Leandro being sued or police brutality, you know, none of that sort of stuff. We had a different vision of what a law enforcement officer, at least my friends, and not that I was close-minded to people. You know who the bad guys, good guys are. With the Chief McGinnis, he kind of weeded out those kind of racist or ignorant kind of guys, you know, as the years went on. He didn't hire them, so they're going to retire out. Now, do you see racial things? Yes. I mean, police officers are, you know, part of the human race. And, you know, yeah, they have their prejudice and, you know, what they think, they're opinionated, you know, what they think about everything. So you're going to have some issues.
Overall,
different from what it is now. And today, when they hire a police officer, as I saw the years come on, the new thing, everybody's pushing everybody to have a BA and an AA. As soon as you got a BA, you can get hired. I think that's wrong, because being a policeman, you got to be more culturally smart, street smart, know how to deal with people. You don't need to be a scientist or an MBA to be a policeman. You know what I mean? You don't need to graduate from Harvard, Yale. Nice to have, but you can't put all your eggs in one basket, make education the number one idea, because police work is dealing with people.
But this is ironic, though. This is very ironic to hear that the modern police force requires an education. You would think that with all of the requirements of education, that police officers today would be much more open-minded and flexible and pliable to a new way of thinking, a diverse way of thinking.
But you know, look at the education right now. Yeah, you got a kid that comes out of high school. He comes from any town, USA. He's under his mom and dad's rule, right? He's getting paid for. He's never had, I hate to say, break a sweat his whole life. He goes to college. He's getting paid for to go to college. I mean, somebody's paying for his college, mom and dad, or taking out loans. He's never had to go out there and work with people. So he goes in an academic situation. He's thinking about his books. You don't really see people. You know, yeah, you see different people on a college campus. But you're sitting there, you're studying, trying to graduate. You're not really mixing a lot of people. And so they come out at 22 years old. They got this thing called a BA or BS. They think they know more than anybody else. They got that chip. I got a BA, BS. I'm going to be smarter than the other policeman that's going to come. I'm going to be a police chief in 4 years, you know. And so the flavor of the month with these HR guys, we're paying these guys an obscene amount of money. That's what they're looking at. We're paying them the same amount of money as we pay our city engineers, you know. Or city, you know, major management settle. So why are we not requiring education from these police officers like we have required education from the engineers, the city managers and stuff? Education is good, don't get me wrong. The thing about police work to me, education shows that you are disciplined, you can memorize, you can take orders, and you have your life together. Because you gotta have your life together to study, you know, write essays and to pass tests. And to graduate, to have the discipline to stay there for 4 or 5 years, whatever it is. That's all education really for me for law enforcement. Think about it. You're a street cop. You graduate in history. Is that really going to help you? You graduate in engineering. Is that really going to help you as a law enforcement officer?
Well, you think with history, though, there is a potential of it giving you a deeper understanding of human beings, right? Or kid who...
It is and it isn't. Because a lot of these guys, they go into police work. They're going in there, I'm going to get me a 4-year degree because I want a job. You know, they're going to take the easy course. But most of these cats go in there and they take classes like criminal justice. And I mean, you're not going to become a lawyer. So why you take, because it's easy, because it's more job related. They think that's going to get them hired. So they got these degrees in criminal justice law for 4 years. And that's all they know is the law. They don't know people. Is that, you know, you know the difference? You know law, you don't know people. You know the books. So you come out with this fancy piece of paper you can put on, you know, and say, you got to hire me because I'm a, you know, I got my BA. And also when you're doing that, a lot of these guys have a clean record and never got exposure in negative. So the police chief goes, oh, this is a perfect candidate. He's got a BA. He has no driver. He got no arrest record, no incident. I go, well, he doesn't have any record because he's never did anything except for go to school. He never went out there and tested the hot waters of life, you know. And no, he's never had to make these life choices for yourself. Or maybe put himself in mind, I got a little trouble. Did you walk away from it? You know, he's never experienced life as an adult. He went from mom to go to college, then became a policeman. Now you're 22 years old and you expect this guy to be given a gun, a book that he can incarcerate somebody, put somebody away in jail, deprive them of their liberty, and also take somebody's life. And he has no experience or, you know, a lot of these guys have no life experience, which is very important. I mean, I can tell you that because I used to train officers. I was a field training officer, too, as a policeman. And I talked to some of these boy wonders coming out, and they had a hard time on the street.
Okay, so wait a minute. So you spent decades in the police work, and now there is an ability for you to actually have a place where you can actually critique the sort of the formation of a police officer. But now we're at a place in history of the United States where police work is not, it's far from perfect. But knowing what you just said, how can I as a citizen get in the mindset of doing the right thing for, like if I was somebody who's planning at the city level, and I hear defund the police, and I think that it's a broken, how do I get in and change it? I don't mean me, but how does society go in and tweak this idea of picking police officers with a level of humanity and humility to really make a change in society and the way we police.
Demand it from the chiefs, demand it from the city, demand it from the state to where you live. You live in that city, demand it from the police chief. We want you to hire and recruit police officers that makes up the population, you know, and hold them accountable and teach them these things, the cultural differences and cultural diversity. At the same time, teach them what it is to be a law enforcement, really what it is to be a law enforcement officer. It ain't what you see on TV. You're not the gun to them, you shoot five bad guys in one day. No, police work sometimes is very mundane and boring. You know?
Probably most of the time.
Teach them, I'm sorry?
Probably most of the time is boring and mundane, right?
It's like this way. You got, it's 55 minutes of boring by 5 minutes of sheer terror every day. Sheer adrenaline rush. You know, you got to be a little bit of an adrenaline drug junkie, which I am. You know, I still am. But anyways, but you got to have an officer that goes out there and really knows his community. I mean, or be part of a community and came to work with. The best police officers I've known in my whole life, I can name only a few of them. I mean, really the total package. Guys here from everyday life, they didn't have no BA, but they had that BA life experience. They went out to the workforce and did their thing, and they became a police officer in their, you know, not their early 20s, but towards their mid-20s. You know, they're seeing what it is out there, the hard, you know, like a regular Joe working, and actually working next to different people, whatever, you're a construction worker, a garbage man, in, you know, whatever, a carpenter. And they went out and worked. They came to a police officer. They have a, it seemed like they have a very well-ed state. They don't get in trouble. But you also have to look at all these other states that what's their criteria of hiring police officers under and their training. You hear all these police officers doing horrific, horrible things. And I'm, you know, I've seen it. It's sad to see it. But who are their supervisors? Who brought these guys to be police officers in these states? You don't hear too many from California, right? When you see major... the last thing we ever saw that was really horrific was Rodney King. How many years ago was that?
Yeah, that was in the 90s, 92.
Yeah, you're talking about 37 years ago.
Yeah.
California evolved and changed. It had to. But why isn't it? But, you know, the other state didn't take seat. You know, you notice these states are still getting horrific, like that thing that just happened in Memphis recently.
Yeah.
That should have never happened with those specialized
units. There were black officers, too.
Yeah. It was just brutal people being brutal.
Yeah.
Race had nothing to do with that. That's just five bad guys that had that badge and gun, and it just went, you know, crazy. But Memphis hired them, right? I mean, Memphis hired, they passed Memphis's test, whatever their vision of a police officer is. And some of those guys, I was reading the paper, I'm not sure it was true or false, but they had baggages coming from other departments. So why would you hire somebody's bad seat, you know?
I mean, that's pretty crazy. That's
to me, it's just insane. It happens. Some guys slip through cracks, but some of those guys had some pretty disciplinary problems. You have that, you know, you as the background officer that you do backgrounds, or you as the police chief, lights and sirens ought to be going off here. Do we really need that to this guy? Do we really need it? I mean, are we really that short? And I know that the department I came from, we'd rather be short and have guys work extra time and hire some guys to come back and cause some, you know, embarrassment or even worse, you know, dishonesty or be having criminal behaviors.
I'm going to ask a simple question, but I know the answer is not going to be as simple. It should be probably a complex answer. Is the police world getting better or worse from this point on, from today? Do you feel like we're heading in the right direction with all of the corrections, like, you know, defund the police and, you know, all this BLM movement stuff? Is it getting better or is it actually getting worse every day?
Well, that's a multiple fault question. It should be getting better, but the thing about it, you have these defunding the police movement, and people would say that with such, you know, cavalier talk, just defend them. Well, when you're defunding police and you take a third of your police force off the street, or you don't hire, and your city's not short a law enforcement officer, then you come around and complain, why is crime rate going up? Why am I having more robberies and murders? I go, well, you have less cops on the street.
Yeah.
To police the people. And time has shown again, just a social experiment that happened a few years ago in Seattle when they had that chop cell with no police in there. Look how people turn in. They turn into total chaos. You know, ripping and robbing and killing people with no consequence because they don't know there's no law enforcement around. Law enforcement defunding the police, I don't agree with that. how about educating that, not only educating the police officer, educating their superiors and what to look for to hire a policeman. You know, every state is different. Unfortunately, every state is different. Every state has a different police officer standard of training. I wish there was all one standard of training. Just like when you join the Marine Corps, there's only one Marine Corps, right? There's only one set of rules. Whether you're from Hawaii or Florida or New York or California, we go under the same
thinking. Same thinking.
Whether you're a Marine from the backwoods or you're a Marine from a city slicker, you go in there, you put that green on, you're the same person with a main weapon. Maybe that has to happen. I have a national police standards and training. I mean, all these 50 states are going to cry. You know, you could have a basic standard and training, they modify it to suit your state's needs for different people, but they don't. Every state does their own thing. Every city does their own thing. And it'll never change unless there's some kind of guidelines. It won't be because people are stubborn. A lot of people get in power because I know everything. I don't need you to tell me what to do. You know, that's our thinking in America. You know, I look at back now being 63 years old, maybe we should have. I'm thinking more and more, I would love to have a national standard of training the way we do business. Get every leader from every police officer standard and training program, all 50 states, because we all have standard and training programs.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the federal level, like FBI, DEA,
they're all the same.
Right? Come out the same.
Why can't it be state?
Quantico, you know, they all push out the same kind of people.
But every state wants their independence, which is bad because you look at that and you look at the way Milwaukee, we don't train the way Milwaukee is. You know, when those guys killed that guy, the things he did, you wouldn't last in California. How's a guy like Chauvin? I think it said Derek Chauvin. Is that the guy's name? How did he still become an officer 27 years that had all those multiple complaints? He had like dozens of complaints of use of force and, you know, different way to treat people. Not even that. How does he become a training officer with all that? Oh my gosh, you know. I'm not sure I can speak for that city, but our city, you know, and even cities around me, you got to be pretty squared away to be a training officer. Like, no problems. Because they don't want you to pass your view of the world on to another, you know, cadet, a rookie, you know, and have you do bad things. Training officers will bring the best out and teach you how life and not a police work.
Yeah.
And you have to take it very seriously.
You spent a lot of time with the Vietnamese community, organized crime sort of areas. Can you talk about that?
I can talk a little bit about it. In 1994, I was a motorcycle policeman. That was my life track, you know. I'm a motorcycle fanatic. That's my thing. I've been riding bikes since I was 15 and a half. Matter of fact, I didn't own a car until I was 25. But anyways, I'm shooting radar in San Leandro. I get on the radio. You need to respond to the station. There's two FBI agents want to talk to you. I'm going, oh my God, I did something wrong. Usually when the FBI comes to talk to you, it means you violated somebody's civil rights. You're going to be walking away in handcuffs or something, you know. I mean, that's what the FBI do when they come to the police department that I knew. You know, I was a young cop. Not really young, but young in the force. I've only been on that time. But about 8 years. I think it was about 8 years I was on, you know. So I come in there and I go to my chief's office. First thing I said, am I in trouble? Do I need my legal defense fund? And the chief started laughing. And the FBI guys are like, confused. What are you talking about? The chief goes, no, Ty, sit down. I got an offer for you. And these two guys came in. One was a supervisor agent in charge. The other one was a regular special agent. He goes, we want you to work and getting into these Vietnamese gambling halls in San Jose, and you're Vietnamese, and I heard that you've done undercover before. I goes, yes, I did multiple stints with Oakland Police Department, working, tracking their organized Vietnamese crimes in Oakland. You know, I did little stints here and there by that time, like a week or two at a time, you know, month, no long-term case. They wanted to borrow me for 3 months. I go, what do you think about it? I go, it sounds like a fun thing to do, you know. My chief, being the wise man that he is, he goes, well, go home and talk to your wife about it first. Tell her about what it involves. And, you know, once those guys left, he goes, really go talk to Jan, because I know you, and it is not going to last 3 months. What do you mean, chief? He goes, I know you, it's going to last a lot longer. You know, him being the wiser man that I was. And he was right. I went and I talked to Jan and my wife. She goes, you know what? If you don't do it now, it's going to be coulda, woulda, shoulda. Wonderful woman. We'll talk about that in a bit, you know. And he said, I'll take care of the kids. The kids were young. I got it back then. Gosh, my daughter was like barely, you know. out of her toddler right before kindergarten started. My son was like a year and a half, about a year when I started, barely walking and, still sucking on his pacifier. She said, I'll take care of the kids' things and you go run, because if you don't do that 20 years from now, you're going to coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Yeah.
And away I went. I went with these guys and they hooked me up with one of their informants. This lady introduced me to a bunch of guys and they took a liking to me. I took a liking to them. And we did this huge Asian organized crime case from dealing with alien smuggling when the Chinese were coming into California. There was a group of Chinese back then that came on like one of those freighters. And they dropped them off right at Fort Point in San Francisco. They all ran into the Presidio. It just happened to be at that time, a bunch of state police and a federal police around there. Just coincidentally, not really, because we told them, hey man, these guys are getting dropped off, but you got to do it a certain way where none of us get exposed. I did that one, and then these guys really liked me. What we did was we hooked up with a guy named Leonard Bali out of Intel Security. He used to be a former police officer. And what we were going to do is we get Intel chips, which was like the hot thing back then. You can go back there in the 90s, but there's no laptop. Personal computers just coming into vogue. They had these chips called the Intel 44. And then there was Intel Pentium chips. And these were hot item chips. He would give me chips like hundreds of thousands and also to use as a bargaining thing.
Damn.
I used them and I was like the guy that was supposed to be doing these mastermind of stealing chips and doing robberies when they came out of Chandler, Arizona, where they were being manufactured. And I would trade his chips for drugs.
So wait a minute. The Intel would provide the federal to give you chips to make these deals.
Yeah, because Intel was losing so many chips being stolen. And so it's good for them too. Let's stop some of these pirating and stop these jacking of our chips. And we can get to these organized crime guys, hit them where it counts. They're going to think twice about stealing chips. So Leonard, he just gave us as many chips as we want. So I'll take a box of Intel and I'll go trade it for drugs. I would trade it for guns. And everybody thought I was a big man because I'm making these big Intel chips for robberies, and coming up these $20,000 deals in 3 days and nobody goes to jail, right? Which was, only the federal government get away, but most local cops, we deal with a couple hundred dollars and you get it busted, right? So when you're dealing tens of thousands of dollars with the drugs and intels and guns and everything, and everybody's walking, they think you're gold. I mean, you're the real deal. It got to a point where we did it nationally, where we're going back East Coast dealing with the triads, and then I got involved in the introduction to dealing the big score, China white heroin, the real heroin that comes in a unit of heroin, like a little square package wrapped up in banana leaves with the dragon head stamping. It really came from the golden triangle. Mm. I dealt with a guy named Tan Dan, Black Tan, because he's a very dark skinned Vietnamese guy. And I got introduced to him. He took a liking to me. I took a liking to him. And he had me deal. The first deal was a $20,000 heroin deal in Quincy, Massachusetts, the middle of Quincy, where he had me, there was only Asians and Blacks in that area. They were very smart to meet him at this little coffee shop. They had me sit there for 2 or 3 hours waiting for this guy because he's outside. And little I know, he's across the street checking the area out. You see a white guy go through, he's got a cop, So they left me alone. I was on my cell phone. Basically, they trust me to go in there by myself, my gun. And I met this guy and did a $20,000 deal, and nobody got arrested.
The feeling you have on the first undercover assignment, I can imagine how scary it would be as a motorcycle cop to all of a sudden go, into these dens of people, criminals. What kind of training prepares you for that sort of activity to go from a regular cop into this sort of undercover life?
Was not that much training. What I did when I first came into there, I met a guy named Willie Reagan at that time. They told me to go be with Willie Reagan, FBI agent. He's very special. Willie Reagan, back in the day, did undercover and went after organized crime guys. and did that Weatherman case for those radicals in New York and stuff. So I go, how the heck does an FBI agent go from the rest of Familia, Mexican Mafia, to dealing with the Weatherman, which is a radical group? And so the guy I hung out with, Tim Hott, my special agent, who's my co-partner, you know, in charge of this case, when you meet Willie Reagan, he'll explain to everything. Go meet him in Fishman's Wharf. He's driving such and such car, and he knows what you're driving. And just meet him at a certain point. I go there. Here comes this guy and walks up to me. He's carrying a man purse. He's got a Hawaiian shirt on. He's got his white hair. He looks like Santa Claus with his beard. He's wearing, Birkenstocks shoes. Hi, I'm Willie Reagan. I go, you are? You know, got a little overweight, and we started talking, and we sat and had lunch for about an hour. This guy was so interesting. Little I realized, he's like famous in the FBI community as the number one undercover they've ever had. Because FBI back in those days didn't do undercover. You know, they just weren't into it. You know, the FBI with their director before the new director, what's his name? I forgot his name now. The one that was director for decades. He wanted all his FBI to be, you know, suit and tie, to be a certain height, all white Americans, you know, and had that FBI cut, you know.
Yeah.
When he left, the FBI changed his, you know, tactics and everything, because, you know, we're wearing a suit and tie with a white shirt and tie. You can't get near everywhere.
No way.
It worked that way. So Willie Reagan talked to me, and then I came back down to Tim Hott, and about a day later, his supervisor got a call. And Willie Reagan goes, this kid's going to do just fine. There's no amount of training. It's going to get what Ty knows, personal. And away I went. It was OJT, on-the-job training. Yeah.
Now, what was about Willie Reagan that made him very interesting?
He had just a way that he can blend into a crowd. And he didn't look like an FBI agent. You got to look at a guy that looked like Santa Claus in a Hawaiian shirt. That doesn't look like a police officer, you know, and wearing Birkenstocks, you know, for God's sakes, you know, dirty, ripped up jeans and carrying a man purse. That is not cop. That definitely doesn't look like an FBI. It's just the way his mannerism and his knowledge of people. You sit down with Willie Reagan, and within minutes, you could have sworn you've known this guy all your life.
Familiar.
He has all those personality, you know, that everybody likes. And that's how he gets in the thing. And then he says, he can do fine. And, you know, as the time goes on, he says, why don't you come back and teach undercover at the FBI Academy?
Oh, shit.
Because guys like you, you know, after, you know, guys like you, maybe Phil Pumpkin, he goes, guys like you come around once in a lifetime. You know?
Wow.
We can't get guys that can get smooth people walk in and just be totally friendly. Just like when I talked to you the first time at Phil. Yeah. You know? I'm easygoing. And so as we went on, the progress of the case got bigger and bigger, where we wanted to make it nationwide. And we were dealing in computer chips, China-wide heroin, alien smuggling, illegal making a driver's license in California. You know, the Vietnamese were very, entrepreneurial, you know. They got involved in everything, as long as they made money. You know, being Vietnamese, you know, it's all about money. It wasn't like, oh, we only deal in heroin. We only deal, you know, such and such. Whatever made money, a lot of money, they were all.
Did you ever stop to think or analyze why these men, these Vietnamese men, were going sideways, were going wayward with crime? Did you ever go, anthropologically speaking or from an ethnographic point of view, why is this happening?
It's the Vietnamese society, you know, Vietnamese culture is, the more money you make, that means you've been, you know, well established, you did a good life, and, you know, you're very, you know, well off. It's all about money. You know, knowing Vietnamese, but at least my generation, it's all about money. What are you for a living? How much money? It's all about prestige and money and living in a big house. At least the Vietnamese came over to America, you know, my generation. I remember the first time I met a Vietnamese girl, seeing that, you know, it going as an adult. Because they don't ask me, how are you doing? What are you doing? How much you make? I'm like, that's a hell of a question. 2 minutes into a conversation. What do you do for a living? They want the doctor, the status symbol. And you know, they wear the Rolex watches. You know, every Vietnamese man is successful because he wears the Rolex watches and lives in a house in Milpitas. You know, they all want that big, they all drive Mercedes.
Right? But at the time when you were in that world and you would make friends with some of these guys and got to know them, they probably were not bad guys, right? Like
they were wonderful guys.
Wonderful guys. Jesus.
One guy sat down there. He said, my undercover name is Tom. We're sitting in a Vietnamese place that sounds like eat. He's looking around. He goes, he saw a couple of police officers come in. He knew them. They were guys with plain clothes, San Jose cops. I knew they were cops, you know. He goes, those guys over there are police officers. I'm going, they are? You know, that's kind of a surprise, you know. But I knew, you know. Because they sat down and a couple of uniformed cops came and talked to him. He says, Tommy, you got to take this as a business. You don't take anything personal. This is about a money man. He goes, how can I explain? Because you're very Americanized. He goes, these things are illegal. That's what I make. He goes, it's like the difference between Ford and Chevrolet. You can imagine that. They're like the competition. They're kind of down on me then. It's not a criminal to be a gangster. It's all about making wealth and money. This is just their way of doing it very fast. Because a lot of these guys were not educated. They didn't have no BA. A lot of these guys, you know,
street.
This generation of Vietnam, it came straight out of the streets to Vietnam. You know, some of the guys don't even have high school diplomas. So without that, we're going to get ahead in the United States, right?
Right.
Besides working at a Vietnamese restaurant or something like that, you know. So he told me that kind of puts the logic in me. Don't think they're a good guy and bad guy. They're trying to get after you. Don't know. Think the difference between Chevrolet and Ford, they're the competition, and they're going to make you and I very rich. Because if it wasn't illegal, you and I would have no money. You know, if drugs wasn't illegal, how are we going to make money? You know, they're not in. They weren't into robbing stores. We're sticking them up. You know, where you got to shoot people. These guys were very professional. It's incredible how much professional they were.
Did you feel like a kinship with these guys in the operation that you were doing?
No, because it's business. And what it is there's is no you are, they invited me into their house.
Damn.
Eat dinner with their family. Damn. Went to the beach with them. I mean, family stuff. Knew their kids. But it's nothing personal, it's business. FBI was very interesting. They checked on me, the headquarters FBI out of Quantico would come and call my handler, the agent I was working with. Hey, check up on this guy. Is he okay? Every few months, make sure I didn't go to the dark side, you know? Because there's so much money and there's so much. We walk into a bar in San Jose. We're let in. We're sitting at tables. They clear tables for us. They knew people. You know? I did a drug deal in Boston and we went to a Chinese restaurant. It was a two-story restaurant. I forgot what the name was. Real famous one in Boston. Standing room only to try to get in, you know. Place was packed. People outdoors waiting for their table. We walk in. He goes talk to the maitre d'. Well, I don't know what he said. Guy, next thing we're let upstairs. They give us a room by ourselves. They block it off with those, you know, the partitions for our own table. And we had no reservations. He just locked up just like that. That's power for them.
Power.
And you know, everything's paid cash. And, you know, they want to fly. They want to treat me a good time, you know. I was sitting there eating food and, you know, bought a bottle of cognac for $800 back then, which was, you know, that Cavorsi. That's the one with the crown head on the stuff. I forgot what it's called. Cavorsi something, you know. I'm not a cognac drinker, you know. To me, it tastes like cough syrup. But I had to be taught how to drink cognac by one of my FBI guys. They were laughing at me. He goes, what do you mean you're Vietnamese? You don't know how to drink coke yet? Yeah. I go, man, I drink bourbon. I'm a vodka bourbon kind of guy, you know.
Did it ever get scary? Did it ever get like life threatening?
It got sometimes it got life threatening, but I never got scared by it. I don't know why. It was kind of exciting, you know.
Or did you know that like behind you, there's like
nobody.
The wall of God? You know, you got the military. You got
I had faith in my own self. And the FBI had faith. Even if we had to cover to help you out, they're way on the outside. It takes some minutes to get in there. The party's over, right? You had to know your surroundings and when you carry a gun, when you don't carry a gun. Not all the time I carry a gun. You know, people think, oh, you had to come and carry a gun. No, because if you go to somebody's house having dinner with their
can't bring a gun.
Wife and kids, why are you bringing a gun? You know who brings guns all the time? Cops. You go to the beach, you're going to carry a gun to the beach?
Yeah.
Who brings the guns to the beach? Cops. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, when they trust me with the FBI trusted me so much with things I did. This one guy out of San Jose, that even other FBI agents questioned, you sure you're going to trust a local? Because there's also a little, you know, suspicion with locals, because, you know, FBI is also the ones in charge of going after police corruption. When I went back to Boston, there was a little bit of a wall there. And because this FBI agent San Jose trusted me so much with everything. I had an ID card, I could walk into an FBI office, for God's sakes. They made me a U.S. Marshal, deputized me a U.S. Marshal. So I had law enforcement powers through the 50 states and their territories. You know, big responsibilities. And I had to do a background through the FBI, because, you know, once you walk in the FBI, they don't let you go anywhere until you pass background. You know, you can't do business like that. I mean, it's put me in a room where I can't walk around the office, get coffee, whatever, go to the bathroom. And so there's a level of trust. And then, you know, being scared, I really wasn't scared that much, to be honest with you. You know, friends of mine goes, you're weird. Kenny, it was a rush. You know, maybe that's my life. It was the rush. And doing something nobody else did. And you're going after really bad people. You're going after top level guy. You're not going after the foot soldier. You're going after guys who actually altered the path of the criminal behavior. We did this case. We ended up with 23 federal indictments throughout the United States. We did search warrants in two different coasts, East Coast and West Coast. You know, half a dozen search warrants. We seized over $500,000 of money. We seized drugs, guns. We put a lot of people incarcerated. They didn't get pled out and dropped charges. They all got convicted. We did real time. We changed the way people were going back then, you know, just going a free-for-all. But nobody was checking on the Vietnamese. Because the Vietnamese, they're not flashy. They just did a lot of criminal activities, you know. You don't see them wearing big gold chains rolling down the street with the music blaring out, you know, real loud and saying loud and proud, I'm a gangster. They're Vietnamese guys I met that dealt drugs and they introduced me to these guys who were dealing in stolen computer chip. I dealt with a guy out of Korea, a guy named Jim Cho, a Korean businessman, multi-millionaire kind of guy. He's buying computer chips for me for cash. He walked up on a computer deal with me with $500,000 in a briefcase, $100 bills. First time in my life I picked up a briefcase that was heavy with money. You know, big legal briefcase, big old box looking thing. I'm like, damn, I never had money that was heavy. And, you know, and those are kind of deals you're actually going after big boys. We did things that were, they said it was the largest Asian organized crime case ever done in the history of the FBI back then.
Holy shit.
And they gave me some fancy medal and stuff, you know. They gave me the best they can do with me. They can't give me a medal because I didn't die. That's what the guy told me. He's laughing at me, you know. But he gave me an FBI Meritorious Achievement Medal. At that time, 1994, he goes, "Ty, you're only one of three that's ever gotten this as a civilian. You know, you'll never meet the other guys who got it because this is one out of three. And you won't know them. They don't know you because, you know, I don't know where the two guys are." But for a Vietnamese guy, it was a wonderful experience. And actually, when you're taking down these guys, it sent shockwave back then to the Vietnamese community. It really did. I came home, kissed my wife, everything's over. She was kind of interesting. And a little small story, at the end of this operation, we're getting ready to take everybody down. They want to protect, right? So we go down to do the big takedown. We went to jail. So they said, we're going to sequester you for a week, make sure there's no hit on you and there's no retaliations and stuff like that. So they sent me with an FBI team. They went and picked up my wife at work. They told her boss, "I'm coming on. These two FBIs are going to pick up my wife." Brought there and got my kids. And they whisked us off to Monterey for a whole week. Gave me fancy money, a budget, everything. We stayed at a real nice hotel right there on Cannery Road. Treated like, you know, fine wine and dining. Only difference is, she goes, "Why are those two guys following us everywhere?" They're my security guard, FBI agents.
So
it was real business, you know.
We are here. Shout out to your daughter, Ashley, who's been on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And because you segued into your wife, and I want to hear the story because Ashley is half Vietnamese, half black. And so Ashley's mother is black, and I want to hear the story of how you guys met.
We met when I worked at East Palo Alto, and she came there to be a dispatcher with. farther back than that, she's very, you know, shout out to her. Very, very smart woman. She came out of South Central LA once on a full ride, academic ride to UCLA, for being a black woman back in, you know, 1977, which is very rare.
It's intense.
She went to UCLA and graduated in theater arts, but also at UCLA, she was a cheerleader. She was UCLA, and shout out to her at the same time. Nothing to do with academic. Her and a couple of friends decided to go try out for the Rams, LA Rams.
Oh, shit. She was
a cheerleader for a year for the LA Rams.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. You know, I heard about it afterwards. She tried with a couple of friends, and she's the only one that got picked. She cheerleaded for the Rams. So something to do. She was one of, you know, there, I think it was, one of her friends went. She had to pick him. So she came out of UCLA with a bachelor's in theater arts, and she moved up to San Francisco at the time. They got working at Menlo Park Police. And I was working at the East Palo Alto Police Cop, young rookie cop, you know, literally my first couple of months on the job. So I met Jan, and she was seemed like the nicest of everybody. And you know, we started going out, different things, you know. I go, well, some of these guys are hitting up on it. I go, well, they didn't work out too well. Why aren't they doing that? I'm not, you know, being Vietnamese, I'm going to sit back and watch. I'm going to watch everybody's failure, so I won't do that again. You know? So I'm going to try something different. I invited her to coffee, which is kind of weird. You know, I invited her to go see art exhibits, you know, things that I like to do.
Well, wait, let's pause right there, because this is a really weird situation, which is she studied theater or drama at UCLA, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You have an art background. You
yes,
study
art. Fine arts. Fine arts. State.
It's
totally different from Vietnamese.
Totally different from Vietnamese, but yeah. Totally different from police people.
Right.
Think about it, right? So you two are both in this, like, again, rigid structure.
Artsy-fartsy world.
Yeah, but both studied art and theater at the at the university level, and you guys find yourself, I mean, it's like weird. When you think about, like, you know, the way the universe is sort of like bending towards, you know, our personality sometimes, and then how we attract and meet the same people within a like the police world. It's just unheard of.
It was, because everything we did before police work was totally different from the natural path of being a policeman.
Right.
She didn't want to be a career dispatcher, just that when she came moved up to San Francisco, that was one of, you know, higher paying jobs. They offer benefits, you know, medical things that you think about, you know. Being a theater arts major, she's working, you know, a small, medium job, trying to get a bigger job. You know, she had to struggle. She goes, well, why am I struggling? I go to be a Menlo Park dispatcher and they give me, you know, a retirement, 401k with medical and everything, and they pay pretty decent. And me, I got into police work in college. I met these two guys that were sitting next to me in art history. And let me tell you, that's the hardest class I ever took in my life. I go, oh my God, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to look at a couple paintings and I'm going to ace this thing. Oh no. We started studying, writing papers about it. I get, what did I get myself into? I studied more for that one class than all my other classes combined. Damn. I only got a B. But I sat next to these two guys and we started talking. They're regular Joes, you know, they're a little older than me, like they're, you know, they're mid-20s, you know, late 20s, you know. And I'm, you know, at that time I was in my, you know, early 20s. And they say, well, no, why you ever thought about being a policeman? I go, oh, hell no. I came from Berkeley, man. I used to ride around my motorcycle with a t-shirt that said Question Authority.
Yeah.
You know, orange t-shirt, you know. I had no aspirations. He goes, I think you'd be a real good policeman. I go, why do you know about police? He goes, we're cops. I go, no way. They told me they were San Francisco PD cops. And they say, y'all, do you have a personality for it? Then I went to work for the campus university police department. They don't want a suit and job they give you. They just send you wherever on campus. I worked in a parking garage collecting money.
I did the same thing for a year. I was security at USC because the boss at that, the security head was like, oh, he found out that I was a Marine. And like same thing, same scenario.
Yeah, and SF State Police, they found out I was a Marine and, you know, and everything like that. And the guy that's in charge of the parking area, he's going to be trustworthy. He's swearing away. I was still in the reserve back then. And so I worked at the parking garage handling all the money. I did real good with it. I made sure they didn't get ripped off. And I told them, you know, hey, these guys are who the students were ripping people off, you know, stealing money. And this guy named Sergeant Nick Bennett, he goes, he really gave me a formal you know, offer. He goes, I'm getting ready to form a department in East Palo Alto. And I'm thinking, Palo Alto, okay. Go down there and be Stanford, you know, good looking women. And go, I'm all in. I kind of left that East Palo Alto, you know, I didn't hear it right. And East Palo Alto was the total, you know, inner city ghetto, highest murder rate in the United States back then. Total drug dealing capital of California, Northern California. Me, I'm thinking, I'm going to walk down there. I'm going to check out Stanford University, watch out the co-eds downtown, drink coffee, and have a kickback job. I went to work at East Palo Alto. I applied. They hired me. He kind of pushed it through. He goes, hey, there's a kid here. He's bilingual Vietnamese, which we had none in the Bay Area at that time. He's a Marine. He's got a U.S. Army. Everything worked out good for him. And he got me hired. Where I went. I first started there as a police service technician doing photography, right up my alley. I was a fine arts major in photography. I wasn't sure I'd be a cop yet. You know, I was looking at her, let me check out this, what it is to work for a police before I raise my right hand. So I went down there for like 3-4 months, and then they had me giving an offer. What do you think? He goes, yeah, it seems like I wanted to do this. And away I went. They sent me to the Oakland Police Academy.
And that's where you met Jan in East Palo Alto?
Yeah, I came back as a police officer. I was an East Palo Alto cop. She was a Menlo Park dispatcher, and Menlo Park at that time dispatched for East Palo Alto.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Because East Palo Alto didn't have his own dispatchers. It's very expensive. So they had Menlo Park, they had a contract. So I would go up there and, you know, get warrants back. They didn't have the computer, warrants on the computer. You had to go up to the police station and pull actually warrants out of a file to go serve people and look for bad guys and everything. Well, they say, hey, we're looking for this guy who did a murder. We need to come up here and get the paperwork so you can have it in your car. You had to go literally manually do it. You know, now it's all, you know, computer and everything. You got to look at, these are the days when we didn't have a kind of stuff. We had a radio and a police car. That was it. No computer, no digicom, none of that fancy stuff they have today. You had a radio in your brain. That's all you had in the police car. So I started meeting her, and, you know, we started becoming friends first. And, you know, we went out to different things. I guess I wooed her over, you know. We were still friends, and I left for San Leandro. And then I came back for a dispatch banquet and stuff, you know, big dispatch banquet, because the county has a dispatch banquet. We started going out, and, you know, she seemed like the right fit. Kind of shocking to my parents, because they didn't know I'm dating at a black woman, you know. So I bring her to my father at that time. It's came over to the United States. You know, he'd been here a few years. I sponsored him to come over here. He's working down at Hewlett Packard as an engineer. He redid his whole life, went to school, left. He was a stud of a soldier, but that was wartime. He had to come up and retrain himself. Here he's in his 40s trying to do everything all over again.
Pretty badass to become an engineer at HP in those days.
Yeah. And it's all training, and he spoke English, I think, because he worked a lot of weird operations in Vietnam as a soldier. So I brought her to dinner. I told my dad, hey, you know, just like, you know, I'm dating a black woman. He kind of smiled, you know, because he's very open-minded. So why don't you come down for our family dinner? Because on his side of family, I met my aunt on that side, and all his friends and cousins. So I walk into Palo Alto to a big Chinese restaurant. I walk in with Jan. And everybody's mouth, you know, they open their mouth. I told my aunt, hey, close your mouth, you're drooling. She's like, you know, couldn't believe what I sat down with. And my dad's giggling, like, oh, you set these people up. You didn't tell them. And then I introduced her to my mother. They didn't get along at all.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Because she was black, or because mm-hmm. your mother?
Yeah, my mom has a racist tint. Her side of family is racist. I'll tell you that straight up. My aunts and uncles from that side. A lot of them are. Introduced her to my grandmother, and my grandmother, my mother's side, told my mom, what's wrong with Ty? He couldn't do better? You know, that kind of attitude, you know? Is something wrong with your son? You know, he's kind of weird. You know? I mean, that's just the way it was. But I had my own life. I lived my own thing. I told Jan all day. My father's side, you're going to be my mom's side. And Jan felt the vibes right off the bat. Your mom don't like me. Now, I was a white girl, or Vietnamese, be all in, you know. But I go, I don't care. This is my life. You know? So we had our wedding. Man, nobody showed up except my grandfather. my father, my mom. That was it.
God damn.
And they got, and they all got invitations.
Everybody got invites and nobody showed up, but mom, dad, and grandfather.
Yeah. And so I understood the message, but it didn't affect me because I go, I'm living my life. You ain't paying my bills. Never got anything from you guys. You know, I'm gonna do my own thing.
Are you guys cool with them now? That part of the family today?
No. To this day, I rarely talk to that side of the family. I talked to some of my younger uncles who at that time were not in America yet. You know, some of them just came more recent, or they were younger then. So they were basically, you know, been told by the elders, don't go to the wedding kind of deal underneath, you know, that's behind the back door kind of stuff.
That's some crazy shit when you think about it, right?
It's some crazy stuff, man. You know,
and yeah, and you just think that it's really white folks that are prejudiced, but it's like, oh my God, like
Vietnamese are very prejudiced.
Vietnamese are
look at the Vietnamese mixed kids in Vietnam. They used to call them Bui Dan, Bui Dan, people of dirt. They never call that to an Amerasian that's white. Amerasian is black in Vietnam too. When I came over there, they were calling them Bui Dan. You see the kids, you know, they couldn't get jobs in Vietnam after the fall of 75.
Yep.
They would give many a job, like, you know, toilet cleaner or something like that, you know. But I never let that affect me. And Jan turned out to be one of the smartest person they knew. I mean, she's a businesswoman. You know, she's director of contracts for a senior director of contracts for a biopharmacy coach. I mean, she's smart. You know, I always tell her where she's the brains of the outfit, you know. I'm just a blue-collar worker, right? Police officer, you know. But we raised two wonderful kids. We taught them with open arms, and we always thought our attitude was, we're going to send them and put our life moving the community at the best public school. Because both of us don't believe in private school, because it's too narrow-minded. Yeah. And also, I got a cash start. I'm a taxpaying citizen. Why the hell do I got to pay to go to school? When, you know, and my Vietnamese side kicked in, it's the F word. It's free, man.
You know,
and if I go to a nice community with a school, it's a tax deduction too for the house. I go, damn, double free, you know?
You know, when people first meet Ashley, and when I first met Ashley in person, you could feel the warmth, right? You could feel the warmth of who she is. Mm-hmm. And the warmth of somebody that you feel in the beginning, it's typically, my experience is that the parents have given this person so much love. You know, this child, so much, an abundance of care, an abundance of love, that the child radiates this warmth, you know. And I don't know what her brother's like, but when I met Ashley, I was like, there's no way her parents are divorced. They're, you know, just like kind of like that feeling that, or if they are divorced, they did a great job co-parenting, or, you know, it's intact, right? That sort of that warmth is there with Ashley. And the job that you both did, you know, having her work in the music and the arts and everything. I mean, audience can listen to that episode with Ashley. And, you know, you guys did a great job. And I'm so happy that, you know, you guys went through that sort of like that chaos with the Vietnamese family on that side, but lived it and survived it.
Well, we came out there and our mentality is we're going to set up the best school possible. So we moved to a city called San Ramon. Phenomenal school district where they boast 93% of their students go to college, which is pretty amazing. You know, this is a public school, high academia. And we figure we can teach her culture at home. I can't teach her the 3 R's, you know. The 3 R's are at school and her friends are in her school. They'll pick and choose what she wants as long as it's not bad. Like, you know, she's not drugs or gangbang, none of that kind of stuff. We're going to let her have free reign, what she wants to study, what she wants to do for a living. Both our kids. Now, one of the kids coming down, I want to be a bank robber. No, we're not going that way. I'll interfere, you know. Or I want to be a gangster. I want to go out there, you know, have 20 kids by 7 different men. Oh, let's talk. But otherwise, we gave her free reign. Ashley has wanted to sing and be an entertainer, since kindergarten. You know, and funny thing about her, she probably embarrassed her. Here she is. My wife and her practice on this big song for one of those Christmas, you know, performance, like preschool. And she's all excited. She's in her alzai, I sing, right? Beautiful blue alzai. She's singing the song by heart. She knew it all in there. She's all that. And then she gets on the stage and she looks around. Instead of singing the song, she's crying. And just flapping her front of her alzai. What the heck's going on? Turns out lady goes, I thought we were saying that I was going to head up there and have it as a solo. I didn't check out these other people on the stage with me. A typical Ashley, you know. She's that always had that strong mind. She didn't see her. No, you know. She's one of those people, I think, her personality, she can make friends with Pet Rock.
Yeah.
You know, and be her best friend.
You know, I stumbled on to her song Rise Again, and I talk about that all the time. And this song Rise Again, it was funny because I didn't realize that that was sort of like a song that she had been contracted to do for a bread company. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes sense. I mean, when you looking back, but I had always thought that this is a black Vietnamese black woman singing this song Rise Again, which is very apt for like a community that fell 50 years ago. So when I listen to the songs, when I listen to the lyrics of that song, it reminds me, it attaches me to a different story. There's a different meaning to Rise Again. So when she performed it at our TED party a few weeks ago, it was just, you know, knocked the socks out of everybody because she can just, you know.
And Jan and I support both our kids equally, literally 50-50. There's no different, whatever path of life you go to, whether it's you can slow to grow or whatever, you know, she went to college and she wanted to pursue this theater arts and singing and musical career. You know, she's a typical struggling artist. You know, she didn't hit big at 17. She got the struggle. She lived in a converted garage, for God's sakes, you know, but we never blinked an eye. We didn't tell her to go, okay, you've had your fun. Now go be a businessman or something.
Right.
Businesswoman. We support her. We used to go to every performance she's ever done in her life since she was as far as she could perform.
Wow.
We used to go down to L.A. just for one performance, drive down there, drive home by Sunday, because we never missed a performance. We didn't do all of them, but, you know, like five in one form, but every new performance she did, we came down, at least one of them during that time, whatever she's doing, whatever she. And some of those performances she did, for God's sakes, were just minutes, but we went down to see her. Some of them was a long time, you know, but some of them watched this whole musical or whatever, and she's on the stage for a blink of an eye, but we were there. We did that all the way from grade school to high school to college, you know, even to adult life. To where now, Jan always taught her, you know, being an African American, people are look at you black, not Vietnamese.
Right.
Because her color is skin area. They look at you, you're going to be black, you know. So whatever you do, you got to be twice as good out in the community. You could expect out of black just to make it even. So twice as good is even, so you got even better at that. You know, whatever you do, whatever you have in life, just keep that in mind. They're going to look at you as an African-American woman, you know, at the end of the day. I know the Vietnamese side has totally taken her in, but that's just recently. That's not been all our lives, you know, this generation.
And that's a new development for us here in L.A., too. In the last 5 years, there's a proliferation of artists and Vietnamese people that are taking, you know, L.A. entertainment scene by storm. You know, there's big productions here, film, music.
Right.
Yeah, we're, you know, the president of Billboard Entertainment is a Vietnamese guy, Mike Van.
Right. You know, and so you know what? They've always been there. They just never given a chance. Think about it, right?
Yep.
They've always been there. They're never given a chance to hit mainstream. But, you know, the Vietnamese always hit their community, you know, like Orange County. All the Vietnamese big singers that are known in Orange County, but outside, before recently, nobody knew them.
Nobody, yeah. But now it's like, it's
everybody knows.
Turn up, yeah.
And so, for her to do all these things, and she's very, to me, we're very proud of her. You're doing it on your own. You did things that I look back, I go, why would we sit there and tell her to do anything else when Jan and I took our own path, did our own thing? I mean, wouldn't that kind of be hypocritical? Do as I say, not do as I do?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we supported her, and the same goes for my son, who went through childhood and early adult. He had a rough time at it, because here he is, and, you know, dad's a police. And I never pushed law enforcement, but I was kind of strict, you know, with certain things. He's a boy, right? You know. But we let him go his own way. And now he's a school teacher teaching in Montessori in Oakland. And he specializes in autistic kids. So he took his own path, what he wanted to do. We let him, and we guide him. And, you know, sometimes we say, don't do this. Just like Ashley, you got to find yourself. I'm not going to force anything on you, but you got to do something. You can't sit at home and play video games, put it that way. I'm not that kind of guy.
Yeah.
You got to go out and try to make a career. And we give them nudges. We don't force anybody. We're not going to say, God dang it, we're going to kick you out. We're going to cut you off because whatever. And both of those kids have friends and, you know, close friends, far away friends from different cultures. And I don't know who comes in the house sometimes, walk in the door. As long as the kid is a nice kid, you know, it's all good. If I think the kid is not a good kid because some of the things he does, I'll let him know, hey, man, I don't want this guy in the house, or I don't appreciate hanging out because these are, and I tell him just, these are the reasons why, you know, and we let him know, you know.
What
I can say because I said so.
Yeah. Ty, thank you so much for, you know, this is a treat. You know, we've gotten to speak a lot to each other in the last few weeks because of, you know, the way this is set up with us, and I appreciate it. And, you know, I am very curious about your mother, and I know that, you know, the work that she does. So I hope that we can get three generations of your family onto the podcast to talk about very interesting lives.
Well, you know what you need to do? Have Ashley Smooth with my noise.
So, all right,
she can do a lot better than I am, and tell her, you know, in her own words, why you need to do this.
Yeah. Wonderful. I will. Ty, thank you
so much. Ashley gets you doing anything for you. Yeah. So.
Thanks again, Ty. I appreciate it.
Take care. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.